Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations, which is aired on the third Tuesday of each month from 2 until 3 p.m. on WGXE Acre 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend to taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Usually at this point, we would introduce our guest.
However, given that today marks the end of our fourth year, we want to take the opportunity to reflect on some of the best moments from 2017. You are about to hear excerpts from shows with Don Skimmerhorn, Adam Patane, Stephen Williamson Link, Thomas Courtney Clack, Ryan Bosch, Jesse Berube, Chris Bubb, and Perry Gardianos.
These are some of our favorite moments, and we hope you enjoy listening to them as much as we do.
The next item is your grandfather's Black Bible. Why bring that?
Daft question.
I don't think it's a daft question. Well, okay, so he's a pastor.
Ka-ching!
This is the second time I've done this. Ask the pastor why they're bringing a Bible.
But yeah, that's because pastors work on their vacation. That's yeah. It's funny because I was just telling you in the break about how, you know, this concept for the show is so interesting to me. When I was thinking about what I wanted to bring, it actually wasn't too difficult of a decision for me as far as the items and the songs. The songs was a little bit more difficult, but I, of course, would want to bring a Bible because if I'm going to be all alone in the middle of nowhere, I want to, you know, have the Word of God with me. I want to, you know, have that reassurance that I'm not truly alone, but that He is always with me.
It's always good if you got it in your hand as well. If you turn around, there's a big bear there, you can smack it in the face.
That's right. It's a big buck. You can take down a bear.
Yeah.
The reason I chose my grandfather's Black Bible was because when I was answering these questions, for some reason in my head, I was kind of thinking, I'm going to go out to this cabin and live there forever. Maybe that was wishful thinking. I'm naturally an introvert.
Sure, Bellamy wouldn't be too happy about that.
Mm-hmm. So,
wait a minute, you don't take me, no?
Yeah, I know. Well, it says no pets. I follow the rules. You know, if I was going to go out there and it was only a few things I could bring, I want to bring something that reminds me of my family and
sure.
Something that's meaningful. I also like old things. I'm not quite sure why. My parents, when I was young, used to collect antiques. And when I was a kid, I thought it was, you know, silly, you know, because they dragged me along to these auctions and stuff on Saturday.
I love auctions.
But I think it influenced me in some way that I like things with history.
I think I'm an auction addict.
Nice.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, especially car auctions.
You can get in a lot of trouble in those.
Perry, one of the things I know you like doing is going to auctions buying stuff.
I've been doing that a lot lately.
So what is it about that you enjoy?
Well, it's great to get a good deal. It depends. Like, I'll look. I'm sort of discriminating. I don't just get anything, but either I get things I need or I get things I know somebody else will need. And every once in a while, you get that diamond in the rough that's like, okay, I don't really need it, but I know somebody else will, and it's really cheap. I got to get it.
So what's the last thing you bought?
Ooh, the last thing I bought when Gander Mountain went out of business.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Bought a whole bunch of mannequins.
Nice. Sell them to a department store? Or?
Wait a minute. You bought human mannequins?
Yeah, I've got a whole bunch of them now. Giving them away, but yeah, I've got a whole.
What do you use them for?
Well, I really only wanted like one or two because I wanted to use them to another side project to make a vacuum form, so I could vacuum form them and then make a whole bunch of others. But now I've got a bunch of them. I don't have to do that now.
Yeah,
and so that was the original thing, and then they were going out of business, so we piled a bunch of them on a dolly and were wheeling them out, and I expected to pay, I don't know, $30, $40 a piece for them. And I goes, okay, it'll be a buck. I'm like, each? He goes, no, just a dollar. I'm like, can I get the rest of them? He goes, yeah, get them out of here. I'm like, okay.
Wow.
So how many did you get?
I don't know. Probably 7 or 8, whatever they had left.
Oh, okay.
A couple of half bodies, of like 2 van loads.
So. Wow.
I was kind of imagining like a terracotta army thing that you could build in your backyard. I guess not. Well, not with 7 or 8.
I was just thinking about sticking them in the ground for Halloween. Just have
yeah.
arms and legs
sticking out everywhere. So, where
are they? They're all over the place.
Sitting on the couch.
There may be one in the back of my van right now. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Well,
I was surprised when you said that. I was expecting you to say something like a piano or something.
Yeah, better be careful who looks in your van. You might get some rumors started. I had a student once that comes in, "Mr. Porter, do you know that Ben Franklin was a serial killer?" And I was like, I've read a lot of history books and nothing like that, remotely close to that, has ever come up. And what ended up happening was, in England, Ben Franklin had a roommate for a time who was a medical student and did autopsies on cadavers and then basically buried the bodies in the basement. And so that's what the article was about. Ben Franklin was not
a serial killer.
A serial killer, as far as we know, based on history and stuff.
Nah.
But anyways, you know, you got to be careful because you never know what high school kid's going to walk by. And
hey.
There's a body in the van.
I escaped of sorts myself. Recently, I went to spend time with a superb family I am great friends with, and they're from Rochester, Mary and Greg Hollis and their family. But they have a camp, and I use the word camp loosely. It's glamping. You know, it's like it's all mod cons.
Roughing it, yeah.
Actually, the first night I was actually kind of outcasted to the camper in the first night to sleep out there, which I enjoy sleeping out there. But the first night was really, really violent storms, and the rain was so heavy that on the canvas roof it was so loud that I couldn't even hear myself think.
Wow.
So I actually got up and thought to myself two things. The severe thunderstorm may kill me, so I'm going to go inside and I'm going to sit in the porch and I'm going to watch the thunderstorm, which I did do.
I had a similar experience up in Connecticut one time when a huge storm. There was every 5 seconds there was lightning, and it was right around me. And I, like a fool, walked out to experience it. Of course, I was able to walk back in, but it was a close thing when I finally came to my senses and says, enough of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I sat in the porch and, you know, and they like doing a bit of hunting, Greg and his family, the men in the family. And they recently bought this, like, rubber torso and head of a, and they've named it, you know, for bow and arrow practice, and they've named it Never Dead Fred or something. So it was in the corner of the porch, so every time there was lightning you could see the silhouette of Fred, you know, and I was like, this is like a scary movie.
Yeah, horror movie.
What's it like, or you must have been told stories about this, what was it like to have a British RAF man land on your lawn in a parachute? I know you were too young to see it.
Yeah, I wasn't born yet. And why I bring this up is because my father had to deal with this poor guy who crashed in the field next to our house. And my parents and my sisters, my three sisters, had all been standing outside watching this dogfight over the house. Our house was on the route that the German bombers took to London. So this poor guy was flying a Spitfire, and he was trying to shoot down bombers. And anyway, he got shot down. He parachuted over our house, and he was coming down in the field next to our house, and one of the German fighters turned back and shot him in his parachute.
Wow.
And my sisters were all terribly upset by the sound. There was this awful screaming sound, which actually was the wind through the torn parachute. And they all thought that it was him screaming. But anyway, they lived with that awful memory. Luckily, I hadn't been born. Anyway, my father had to deal with this. He wrote a letter to the parents of the pilot, and became great friends with the boy's mother, and she then, when I was born, she became my godmother.
Ah.
And I was when I was christened, they tacked the name Peter, the name of the pilot, onto my names, and so I've carried his name.
A great homage, isn't it?
And the fascinating thing is that my father put up a little wooden cross near the road where he fell, and I went back 50 years later and to see if I could find that wooden cross, and I was amazed to find that there was a full-scale memorial there with a great big oak carved cross and with his photograph on it. And every year at Veterans Day, the local they have a little march from the village with the band.
That's amazing.
And they come down to his
his
memorial. So it was lovely to see that.
You know, you mentioned Parkinson's and breaking your hand, and that reminds me of Michael J. Fox, who played Marty McFly in the Back to the Future series. And in that series, he is taunted by a peer of his, Needles, who challenges him to a drag race.
Yeah.
And in the future, we realize that because of that drag race, he gets into a car accident with a Rolls Royce, breaks his hand, and he's no longer able to play the guitar and pursue his career as a rock musician. And the guy that played Needles was Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Wow.
And
that's a segue right there.
Your next song is Naked in the Rain by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah, anyone who knows me would probably think, God, that was a fantastic segue. It's like you're a professional or something.
Yeah, he does do that.
Now, Jesse, running.
Yes.
Professional running.
Yeah, yeah.
How does one become a professional runner?
Well, I started my professional career and at the end of college. I actually stayed for 5 years in college, and I ran out of eligibility. And
no pun intended.
Yeah, and one of the coaches who was starting up this professional team, he was trying to recruit some runners, and he came across my name, and he asked me if I would join the team, and I said yes. So I got hooked in with that.
Now, does it when someone is professional and a professional athlete, does that involve getting sponsorship and running for money?
Yep. Well, I was kind of like the walk-on of the team, so I got a uniform, but it was sponsored through Nike. And I would travel from Geneseo to Syracuse. That's where the team was from. And I would go out there and train, maybe every other day or two times a week. And, I got hooked in that way. But, don't get me wrong, training with these guys and in the sport of running, when you're a professional, you're just scraping by. So, right. No one's getting rich.
Well, it's like a lot of things, isn't it? You see a lot of these when you watch the TV in a sport or an activity, you're seeing the cream of the crop.
Oh, yeah.
So, you see these high-end athletes that are running and they're making millions and all that. That's the 1%, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Most of these, pretty much everybody I was running was just, scraping by paycheck to paycheck. So, holding on to that dream.
Yeah. It was somebody I heard, the Summer Olympics were this past summer, right? And some celebrity like Alec Baldwin said, just for a frame of reference, an average person should perform in every event. Because you see these people on TV and it's like, okay, they're running fast. What's the big deal? But if you compare it to a normal person, it's like, oh my gosh, they're superhuman.
Yeah.
Get them a cape.
How long is your work today? 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's high pressure, though.
I think I can handle it. 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. About 9.59 seconds.
Yeah. What was it like growing up on 1,000 acres of farmland?
It was great. I loved it. I think most people who would have my life would say, "Oh my gosh, there's nothing to do." But it's just a different.
On the contrary,
it's a different lifestyle. So you gotta think of things to do, on your land. So what are you gonna do in the field? What are you gonna do in the woods? It was awesome. I loved it. I love wide open spaces. We used the woods to run in, to train in. We were always out in the woods constantly making forts, all of that. And then I went to college, and it was kind of more of like a city, type area. And I was like, oh, my gosh, what do I do now? I have no woods,
I think
that must have been an adjustment, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You just find different things to do.
Well, I think for some perspective here, Jesse, you went to Geneseo.
Yes.
And you're referring to that as a city.
Yes.
So that also, if anyone understands that Geneseo is a profoundly rural area, it shows just how rural it was where Jesse was growing up.
Oh, yes.
and another thing I need to emphasize on behalf of the three of us, we are recording for the first time outside tonight.
an outdoor, beautiful
today, rather, today.
Catskill evening out on the deck, surrounded by trees and the sound of birds and a little kitty named Ruby, who's adorable.
Yes, my wee cat.
Mm.
She's made an appearance in previous shows.
She has. You sometimes can hear her in the back. Actually, on Larry Gambin's show, you could hear her bringing. And did she begin chasing a chipmunk or something?
Yeah, it was Thunderdome.
Yeah.
In Thunderdome in the living room.
Beyond the Thunderdome. Your next item, Chris, is an old pair of white pumas. Now, you say puma or puma?
Puma.
We say, yeah. In Scotland, we say puma.
And aluminium. I'm confused about that. Can you clarify that?
Aluminium?
Aluminium.
Yeah.
There's no inium there. It's just aluminum.
No, aluminium.
But I don't think there's an ium.
It's aluminium, Mike.
Because it's spelled U-M, not I-U-M.
I know, but we were there first.
All right. Well,
I'm confused just hearing the word.
I can't argue that. You were.
Aluminum. Do, 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 do. Aluminum. Do. So this pair of pumas.
Yeah. These pair, so must have been like 20. I got these pair of white pumas for my birthday.
I'm sorry, Chris. And jaguar. You goof around with that word too. It's jaguar.
Jaguar.
Jaguar. No, jaguar.
And it's Van Gogh.
Yeah, also weird. Chris, I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir. Please continue.
Yeah, no worries. So I had these pair of white pumas that I got for my birthday, and shortly after they went missing, and you know, didn't know where they went. And probably a couple months after that, I was down in Florida visiting a friend. We go out the night before, hang out, and then you know, get back and crash. And so when we wake up, you know, I kind of groggy, open up my eyes on the couch and look over and see this pair of white pumas. I'm just like,
His pair of white pumas.
Well, I you know, I'm like, huh. And I started putting the pieces together, and I'm like, wow, he was in town that night, you know, around that time when my pumas went missing. So I went over there, and, yeah, sure enough, they were mine. So, you know, ran into his bedroom. I think he was still sleeping. I was like, hey, what are you doing? Yeah, so I got them back. And
did he steal them?
Yeah, he said he was going to throw them out, which was the worst part. He planned, he's like, they didn't fit. But he needed shoes to go to the airport, and he couldn't find his or something. So
that's a really cool mate, isn't it?
Yeah, he kind of left me high and dry on that one. But
as a joke, you could leave two pumas on his couch, not the shoes, the kitty cats.
That would be a
Since you needed
joke.
Pumas, I thought I would leave you a couple. They're from the Miami Zoo.
Good luck. Good luck. But yeah, those white pair of pumas last me all through my time in New York. So when I was in New York, right, like a kid out of college, you know, paying school debt, you know, making enough money to survive in New York, but certainly not ample means. So a lot of time I use my time to walk. I probably walked the entire island like 5 or 6 times.
Wow.
And,
no kidding.
So, I mean, they're obviously ridiculously comfortable, right?
Do you still have them?
So I took pictures of them, but
this guy's uncomfortably in love with a pair of shoes, Mike.
Hey, shoes are great.
Your shoes are awesome. You would love them. You'd be like, I need to get a pair of those right now. You probably would, you might even steal them.
It's been done before.
Are you wearing them tonight?
No. So,
doesn't love them that much, does he?
Well, it was a long time ago. They probably got worn. He's walked around Manhattan 6 times or something.
Yeah, there were some holes, so I took pictures and then I threw them out.
Poor things.
Have you got the picture on the wall?
Not on the wall. I think I could find it. So that's.
Now, did you know that the Puma factory originated? It was two brothers, right, in Germany. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the city, right? But it was Christopher von Wilhelm Dassler, right? Who was a factory worker, worked in a shoe factory. To cut a long story short, his brother, Rudolf and his younger brother, Adolf, right? Christopher von Wilhelm was the father. And these two boys, Rudolf and Adolf, were the sons. And the two of them, after a long period, ended up opening rival shoe stores.
Really?
One was Puma and the other one was Adidas. right?
No way.
So this is how the guy, one of the sons, came up with the name Adidas. He took his, the guy was called Adolf, who used to be called Addy, or, you know, and he took the three letters of Addy and took the first three letters of his last name, Das, as in Dassler. So Adidas, and that's how he made the name Adidas, right? And one of the reasons why he took umbrage with his brother and opened up a competing store was because his brother, during the war, they joined the Nazi party.
Right? Oops.
And yeah,
bad move.
And then there was a growing rift between the two of them, and it came to breaking point in 1943 when there was an Allied bomb attack. Addy and his wife climbed into a bomb shelter that Rudolf and his family were already in. He said, "Here are the bloody bastards again," Addy remarked, apparently referring to the Allied warplanes. But Rudolf, due to his apparent insecurity, was convinced his brother meant him and his family. When Rudolf was later picked up by American soldiers and accused of being a member of the Waffen, he was convinced that his brother had turned on him. So that's why they split up and ended up opening two competing stores.
Wow.
Right? Now, I was talking about your neck earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
The place where they live, so it said Puma and Adidas entered a fierce and bitter rivalry after the split, right? The town where they lived, I'm going to try and pronounce this right because it's a massive German name, Herzogenaurach. Herzogenaurach, right, was divided on the issue, leading to the nickname the Town of Bent Necks. People looked down to see which shoes strangers wore.
Wow, no kidding.
So if they wore Puma, then they were for this legions of people, and if they wore the other one, Adidas, then...
So weird to think about.
Interesting. So that town, Herzogenaurach, is known as the Town of Bent Necks.
Nice.
And that's for Puma. Mm. You got your beloved shoes from.
Yeah, I guess I'm glad they're Pumas rather than Adidas.
and now, thanks to cell phones, it's going to be the planet of bent necks before the century is out, because we're all not looking down at our shoes, we're looking down at our phones.
Yeah, and, I know.
You know, Chris, a little while back, we had a gentleman on the show named Larry Gambin.
Yes.
And Larry designed the Puma logo.
Really?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, wow. Graphic artist.
Is it around these parts?
Yeah, he lives in the Catskills.
Wow.
And had his artwork up in, what is it, Studio...
54.
Studio 54, yeah.
Okay.
And he had one famous sportsman was doing all the modeling of his stuff. It was a guy called Ewing.
No, I don't know.
As a guy, a basketball player called Ewing.
Oh, Patrick Ewing?
Patrick Ewing was one of the guys. He said he worked with quite a few, but that was, he said Patrick Ewing was a gentleman.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's a small world. You love Puma, and our previous guest produced their logo.
The great logo. My beautiful wife bought me a pair of Pumas after that show. I needed new shoes, and they're great. I love those things.
George loves Puma.
Yeah.
Yeah, George always loves Puma.
George does our music. Ah. Our theme music, yeah.
Nice. Former guest. Yeah. And he has a radio show in Scotland. Mm. George Patterson has a radio show on Cumbernauld FM.
Your next item is your favorite sweater. Why take that?
Well, as we all know, that the Catskills in the mountains can be kind of chilly at night, and kind of like a blanket, you would want to snuggle up on a couch and maybe reminisce about things in your past, in your life. And I have a sweater that I don't obviously wear anymore, but I do have a sweater that has been made for me specifically, again, from my grandmother. And she was just a terrific woman, you know, growing up. And when my parents had to work, of course, my grandmother watched me. And you don't think of things like this when you're younger, but as you're older and you get, you know, married yourself and have kids yourself, you really do appreciate the heirlooms that, you know, you've carried with you from year to year and decade to decade. And, one of the things that would really reminisce in my mind to take me back in a days would be a sweater that my grandmother made. It really isn't any special sweaters, you know, like the reindeer doesn't, you know, the nose doesn't glow or anything. But
I was going to say, is it one of those ugly ones?
No, it's not really. It's just basically one color. It's red, and it's just just the way she made it, and it's just.
So was it made for you when you were a kid?
Yes.
So if you try to put it on right now, you'd be like a zombie. You'd be like standing there, can you move? Yeah. Yeah, is it made of wool?
No, it's made of cotton.
All right.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Now, sweaters have been worn since the late 19th century. That's when they really took off. The 1800s were a pioneering time for style. I guess every decade, every century, they have their own unique style. But so sweaters, late 1800s, but holiday versions only began to sprout up in the last several decades in the United States. Bill Cosby,
he was
a major ugly sweater guy. That was his kind of trademark. Chevy Chase in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Yep, I remember that one.
Had the ugly Christmas sweaters. December 15th. 2017 is National Ugly Christmas Sweater Day.
Wow.
And I find it a little charming, actually. Because with some of the genuinely ugly ones, there are also some that are kind of ugly, but then really cool. There are some with like Star Wars themes.
But they're ugly. They're cool in their ugliness.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You can pull that off. And now you can buy ugly sweaters, you know, all over the place. It's not...
I see an ugly sweater parade in your future.
I might. That would
I
be
could
great.
See him button at a radio station somewhere. Like he's the voice of the ugly sweater parade.
Yeah, live remote. Yeah.
And here he comes. It's John from Vermont. He's representing
a disappointing turnout this year. His sweater is entirely too attractive. He went with something from the L.L. Bean line, which just doesn't live up. Sad day today for ugly sweaters.
Mike, do you have an ugly sweater?
You know, I don't. I guess that's open
that's,
to...
That's what you think.
Yeah. Interpretation, yeah.
Open to interpretation. Yeah. Me being in the sweater might be enough just to make it ugly.
So you've never thought, like in school at Christmas time, I'll wear a sweater with like Rudolph on it or something like that?
I never have, but now I am. Now I'm thinking that I might try to pull it off and see what happens.
One ugly sweater comes to mind when I was in school during a certain concert. It was mixed with six different pictures on the front. And it was like snowflakes and reindeer and, you know, Santa Claus and, you know, just holiday stuff. And now that I look back upon, you know, that day, I'm like, why would I wear such a thing? But
Well, that's the thing. That's the great thing about fashion, isn't it? As Mike said right at the beginning when he was mentioning this. When you look back to like the 70s and stuff like that, you know, the guys had the long mutton chop sideburns and the flares, the shirts had the wide collar and stuff like lapels and stuff. And you know, and then you go to the 80s and people have got mullets
you guys are wearing short shorts and tube socks pulled up to their knees.
Here's one for you, parachute pants.
What are parachute pants? I don't remember.
Those were the pants that had the little Velcro tabs on the side that you pulled towards the front to make it look like an MC Hammer type of pant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those. big legs.
And did you see you guys on the dance floor with them on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Thinking they were cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Have you guys ever seen Icelandic sweaters?
No.
Usually made out of wool. They're really cool. My sister and her husband went to Iceland for their anniversary to Reykjavik, and they got these sweaters. And those are pretty neat. They're really thick, robust, and they have usually pretty cool designs on them. Mm-hmm. Pretty classy. So that's something. If you don't want an ugly sweater, get an Icelandic one.
It's probably pretty pricey, too, if I can imagine. Yeah, I mean, anything that's going to keep you warm is going to be... good investment. Yeah.
When I was a teenager, there was these T-shirts that were called Y cardigans, and it was like these American type cardigans with a Y on it, and it was I think the Y stood for Yale College, Yale University, and they were just at the time you're like, oh, they're fantastic. So you look back, you're like, oh, look at the state of that. I remember my aunt Isa made these, knitted these. Sweaters that were like yellow and black stripes, a little like bumblebees. And she knitted them for her sons, and then her sons were like 4 years, 5 years older than us, and then they you know grew out of them, and we got them. Me and my brother Brian, and we were to look like idiots, you know, 5 years later.
Those are the kinds of pictures that come up, you know, when you're turning 50 or, you know, your 50th wedding anniversary or whatever, something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, yeah, the wall of shame. Your next item is a photo of your mother and father on their wedding day. Tell us about it.
Well, this picture I actually came across, unfortunately, I'd never seen it until after she passed, when we were going through a bunch of photos and trying to make kind of a collage for her service. And it's a photo that I had never seen, and it's spectacular. It's the two of them, much younger than me. They were, I believe my mom was 19 and my father was 20 at the time. And they're standing in front of a 64 Studebaker Hawk, which is one of the family cars.
Right.
And it's just one of these great shots where her veil was just kind of blowing in the breeze.
Brilliant.
And it's very, you know, early 80s photography, so it's like very heavy flash, very grainy. My dad had the typical cop mustache back then. So
cool.
So it's just, it's a great photograph, and I just really cherish it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I did a little reading about weddings. I found that the average budget for a wedding, you want to take a guess? What is the average budget for a wedding? What are you saying?
In today's world?
In today's world, yeah.
$22,000.
$22,000, says Adam. $1, Bob.
$35,000.
The average is $20,000.
Wow, well there, done, Adam.
Yeah, well done. You know, being a photographer, I shoot a lot of weddings.
Yeah. And the average of
see,
that.
See, he'd an advantage.
And in the there's also, I found the average amount out of that $20,000 that's reserved for photography. Do you guys want to take a stab at that? The average.
Well, he's no getting, I guess.
What do you think, Andy?
$2,000.
$2,000?
$2,500.
It is $2,500. That is the average that they budget away. There's about 101,500 wedding photographers in the United States. We have one here with us today.
The wedding photographer.
Tom, your first item is going to be a panoramic Kodak photo of the boat you came to the USA on.
Yes. It's an extraordinary story. You know, I came over from Antigua to New London, Connecticut on a 45-foot trimaran, and on the way we stopped off in Bermuda.
Can I stop you? How did you get on the boat in the first place?
Because I was working on this. I'd run away from the BBC. just because I needed a break. I never went to university, and I wanted to do something crazy. And BBC said, you know, go away for 6 months and have a great time, and your job will be waiting for you when you come back. And that was nice. So I got a job on this motor yacht, charter yacht in Antigua in the Caribbean. And I had a fabulous, fabulous time. Didn't make any money, so I didn't have any money to go home. So I hitched a ride on this 45-foot trimaran that was going to Connecticut. And I'd met a lot of tourists, American tourists, and this family in Connecticut said, come and stay with us. So we were almost there. We stopped off in Bermuda on the way. So we happened to bump into the tall ships race from Lisbon to New York. Wow. And so all these fantastic, huge sail ships were out there, and we sailed around looking at them and taking photos. Anyway, 2 weeks later, we came to Connecticut. I went to stay with this family in New Canaan, Connecticut. And after 2 days, they said, we're going to take you to New York and show you New York. We took the train into Grand Central Station. And in the Grand Concourse in those days, along one whole side of the Grand Concourse, was a huge panoramic photograph of Kodak. It was a Kodak ad, really. And I look up, and there is the tall ships, and right next to them is the boat I just arrived on. And I'm screaming and yelling, saying, that's me. And they're saying, shit, you're really embarrassing us, you know. And so it was just extraordinary. And 25 years later, I was doing commercials for Kodak, and they sent this guy down from Rochester. And I told him the story, and he said, oh, I remember that photo. And 2 days later, Kodak sent me a copy of that photograph. Yeah. And it's amazing. It's a beautiful thing. And I can prove that I was there, because stuck on the back of the picture, I have the photo that I took at the same moment. It's the Eagle, U.S. tall ship, the Eagle, and I was taking a photograph of it. And in the background, you can see the airplane that was photographing this photograph.
Unbelievable. So, which boat are you in this picture?
On the left. on the left.
The one with three sails?
Yep.
Yes.
And you can just see I'm the really good-looking one.
The really good-looking spec.
They developed, the photograph at Grand Central was developed in a swimming pool.
Oh, wow. That
seriously?
Yeah, it's that big.
Boy, that sounds like a lot of photochemicals.
Yes. Yeah.
Somebody got sick.
Divers and getting in for it and stuff.
Now, David, your next item is a film camera and the means to develop the pictures. Why a camera and all the gear?
Well, first of all, I'm an amateur photographer, especially when I'm in nature. There are many things that I see. I find that I'm fairly well detail-oriented, not just a general view, a scenic view from a mountaintop or whatever. I can focus on the smallest blade of grass if it interests me. In fact, I love to see some of these wizened oaks that have been cut down and they're just left and they're so, the bark is so tortuous that it's really amazing to see what nature can do when allowed to do so. So I would take it because I would want to take lots of pictures when I'm there, when I'm not busy reading,
chilling,
or writing, or playing the piano.
And you'll need, now would this be black and white photography or color photography?
It wouldn't matter.
Yeah, and wouldn't matter. You need all the chemicals for that. Maybe you could develop at night when it's dark. Camera comes from the Latin word camera obscura, which means dark chamber. And photography comes from the Greek, meaning drawing with light, photography. And I have a bit of trivia for you gentlemen.
Oh, come on.
I can't wait.
From in which country was the world's first color photograph produced?
Color photograph.
Which country was the world's first color photograph produced?
I don't know the answer to that.
You want to take a guess? Any guess? Any country?
Germany.
Germany. Andy?
France.
Scotland.
You're kidding me on.
Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell produced the world's first color photograph in 1861, and it was a tartan ribbon.
A tartan?
You serious?
Yeah.
No
yeah.
bad accent, by the way.
Thank you.
Yes, not bad.
Hanging out with Andy too much. So I thought that was fascinating. You know, in some of these previous shows, we've been talking about everything that comes out of Scotland, and it's just every show, every bit of research I do, it's like, really? Scotland again? Calculus and kilts and bagpipes wasn't enough. You had to come up with everything, including color photography.
Well, don't forget golf.
Golf.
And don't forget bagpipes.
Yep.
Haggis.
Which I can't stand, I'm Haggis. Sorry to say. I can listen to about, I went to one up in outside of Amsterdam. There's a big Scottish thing every year. You mustn't go to it.
Oh, when you say Amsterdam, you mean New York, Amsterdam?
New York. It's below Amsterdam. It's not in Amsterdam. It's it's below.
Schenectady or something?
No, it's a smaller town, and every year they have 50 bagpipe bands there, and
wow.
They're throwing the caba.
Tossing the cable.
Which is a giant tree trunk.
Yes.
Which was guaranteed to give you a hernia.
Yeah. And maybe something else. hemorrhoids or something.
Yeah. A lot of great Scottish culture that's carried through here in the United States.
Yeah. Don't forget Scotch.
And Scotch.
There's How could you too? Forget Scotch?
Well, we don't.
Into the next item, which is the Yashica twin reflex camera. Is that right? Am I saying that right?
So I did actually bring this.
Oh, brilliant. Because cool. I was thinking, yes, because I saw that
so
on.
I wanted you to just hold it and feel it and see why I wanted to bring it. So this is
great because I was actually looking at a YouTube video of this, an old guy showing you how it works and stuff. This is great.
Wow. So it's that camera is from 1957, I believe. It's kind of tough to tell. It could be 57 to 58.
No, it's a twin lens, yes.
Twin lens reflex. So if you hand it back over here, you guys are handling it like it's made of porcelain.
So, just a way to break it.
So you can hear how metally it is. So as you look through the top here, you look through this lens, and then this lens is actually taking the photograph.
Oh, it's like a mirrored lens.
Yep. Yeah. So it's not like single lens reflex, which would be SLR, which is the cameras that you think of where you're actually looking through the lens.
Yeah.
You look through the top and then you look, you actually see the image here, you focus here, and these two lenses are linked.
Hmm.
And then the actual photograph is taken through the bottom lens.
Yeah.
It was a very popular design. And I've been searching for a camera like that for many, many years, but they tend to be very, very expensive. And I wound up trading it for an older Nikon single lens reflex.
And, well, see, the video I was watching that showed you is this old guy, and I don't know where it was, somewhere in Europe, and he was speaking a foreign language, so it was like subtitles.
Yeah.
And he was showing you how to put in the film
yeah,
and showing you, and it was, you know, basically showing you how to use it in the aperture, mm-hmm. and the
yep.
just, you know, winding it on and all that. And it was basically saying that it's no very good for action photographs. No, it's no. more of a it's, static
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, you really, I mean, the best way, this is really built for like landscapes, that kind of thing, because right. it's very tough to focus. It's very fiddly. And that's why these cameras kind of lost popularity.
Right.
But people were using them right up until the digital age ended because it's a larger format. So it uses 120 film instead of 35 millimeter. So
right.
the negative is much, much bigger. So you right. get a much higher quality. And these cameras were so inexpensive with great quality. So they were very, very popular, especially with right. landscape photographers and studio photographers.
So do you still use it then?
Yeah, there's film.
Where do you get your film?
You can get B&H down in New York City. Locally, there's Artcraft Camera right in the Marshalls Mall.
Oh.
So definitely check
you
them
still,
out.
Like, do yeah. you use like Kodak film and stuff?
I generally use T-Max because I develop at home. So
right.
I just tend to shoot black and white so I can process it myself. I have a darkroom in my garage.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So this camera, like I said, it's not the oldest camera I have. It's not, but it's by far the nicest, and right. it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's really cool. It reminds me of what the astronauts used. In yeah. their spacesuits. Yeah. I guess it's not the same thing, but
yeah.
for if someone listening isn't quite sure what it looks like, it's kind of, you know, a box with two lenses on the mm-hmm. front. The top pops open and you can look down in, and
right. yep.
and they needed right. that if you yeah. believe we went to the moon.
which I do.
Yeah.
yeah.
I'm pleading the is so. It the fifth you plead?
Yes.
I'm you pleading the fifth on it.
You were involved in the cover up?
No, I plead the fifth.
You don't want to incriminate yourself?
No, I don't know. I don't know what you believe. I don't know. Sometimes I think, yeah, they burn the moon. Sometimes I think, nah. So I don't know.
With a powerful enough telescope or a laser, you can actually like look at the stuff that we've left there.
Ach, a wee.
Yeah.
Just like an American delete litter behind.
There's a laser reflector on the moon.
That's a McDonald's.
Like, you okay. can, like, if you go to, like, if you go to, like, a fairly higher-end, like, science college, you can point a laser at the moon and measure the distance.
Wow.
I don't believe you can see the flag. Or a golf club.
Well, you can't, you can't, I don't think you can see the flag with a telescope.
Footprint.
But yeah, that would have to be pretty a pretty long lens.
Twinkie.
Yeah. Just that golf yeah. ball bouncing.
Yeah, like still bouncing, yeah. just bouncing.
Well, and the next stop is going to be Mars, right?
Yeah, hopefully.
Apparently there was a bar. Somebody opened a bar in the moon. And the two astronauts went in, and the next day, one of them said to the other one, "Did you enjoy that?" He said, "Nah, it wasn't very good." He said, "Well, what's up with it?" He said, "There wasn't really any atmosphere." Sorry.
Well, I won't give away too much, but I do have a couple items of trivia for you gentlemen about these books. Andy, okay. if you haven't read it,
nope.
you're going to have a hard time, but we'll try it anyway. First question. What does The Hitchhiker's Guide have printed on the front cover?
Do not wear Crocs.
In large, friendly letters, don't panic.
Nice. Don't panic. Very good. And next question. What is the answer to the ultimate question in the book?
Keep your toe.
That's a good guess.
Yeah.
It's 42.
Yeah.
42.
42 is the answer.
Don't tell me why, because I'm going to read the books.
Okay.
Yep. There's going to be people driving saying, 42, 42. Could you maybe name drop for us?
Oh, well, I did Mrs. Dale's Diary, which was right. a daily soap opera, which was priceless. You know, the Mrs. Dale is this beautiful, soft-voiced lady, and she was played by this really hard-edged Oh, bad.
She's got a lovely voice, but she's got the body that doesn't go with the voice.
She was in every way scary, but but she did a brilliant job. And so things like that were fun. I did the Archers.
Sorry, mate. Sorry. Which is still going on, obviously.
It's still running.
Is it the world's oldest soap opera?
Yes, I think it is.
On the radio, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Still, yeah. No kidding.
And that was fun to do. I had a dramatic moment in there where I was doing the sound effects, you know.
Yeah.
And I came to a point where a telegram with terrible news was delivered.
Yeah.
And so I had to, the actor wanted to open it himself. And so I had to have it ready to hand to him, and then he would open the envelope. And in rehearsal, I hadn't noticed that he totally destroyed the envelope. And so when it came time for me to hand him the envelope, I didn't have anything to hand. And so I ran across the corridor into the ladies' room and tore off a couple of scraps of toilet paper. Because in those days, toilet paper was this horrible, shiny, crinkly stuff.
Yeah, it looked like tracing paper.
Oh, Bronco is called. Yeah, yeah. Oh, awful. It really hurt to wipe yourself with
it. Yeah, it was sad.
How did this ever make it to market?
Yeah, was then, of course,
Tom, you're bringing up some nasty Scottish memories here.
So I ran back in, you know, just in time for the queue, and I handed him the two pieces of toilet paper. And he lost it, and he just went right into the microphone, and everybody had to take a moment to recover, because all this was live, right?
Yes, yes. You
know. Have you heard of the story where David Lee Roth had a tantrum in his dressing room and caused $97,000 damage?
I could see that. I've heard stories of David Lee Roth hanging out with the guys from, who's Tommy Lee? Motley Crue. And he was older than them, and just the drugs and the craziness and the girls and the cops kicking. The cops kicked down the door of their apartment, and it had gotten kicked down so much. Motley Crue had an apartment, and that the hinges weren't even on. And David Lee Roth was by the door, and the cops kicked it in. They ran in. He's under the door, and they're stepping on him, arresting people. They probably pull him out from under. He's like, oh.
Well, the reason for this particular incident was because David Lee Roth went backstage. And in his contract, a certain color M&M was supposed to be withheld from a bowl of M&Ms that they requested. Trivia time, what was that color M&M? Andy?
Blue.
Blue?
They probably didn't have blue ones. I say red. He's probably allergic to red dye.
The answer is brown.
Oh.
Brown M&Ms. Now, a lot of people think, wow, what a diva, how arrogant that.
Hold on. Perry's trying to rationalize it. He's probably allergic to the dye. He probably drank four bottles of tequila, you know.
So, that's what's going to do it, is that M&M dye. But, you know, so a lot of people think, geez, what an arrogant jerk. You know, he's picky about the color M&Ms, how insane. But there was actually a method to this. Van Halen was maybe the first group to go on the road with these massive, massive three-truck sets and equipment and gear. And they would take this not just to huge venues, but to smaller places. And they had an issue with especially small venues not reading the contract, not reading the agreement, and not realize, because they're not reading it, they're not realizing that, you know, there's going to be tons and tons of equipment on the stage, and if your facility can't handle that, it's going to do major damage or potentially be dangerous and kill people, you know, if the set caves in, or if your power can't handle all the electricity needed and the sound and all that stuff. So they included in their contract this little tiny line that said no brown M&Ms. And it was a test so that David Lee Roth could, once they get there, everything's all set up or they're going to set up, he goes backstage and he looks at that bowl of M&Ms and he can see right away if they have nitpicked and read every line and knows that if there are brown M&Ms, they haven't read all the different specifics about the requirements that the group has, and it can put the group in danger. Okay. And in this particular case, this was out in Pueblo, Colorado. He did, from the tantrum he threw when he saw brown M&Ms, he did $12,000 damage. The remaining $85,000 in damage was because the equipment sank through the stage floor that had been placed there or set up or whatever.
Thus, that argument was right.
Yeah, there was a reason for it. It wasn't just because they didn't like brown M&Ms. It's because this is really dangerous and people can get killed because people aren't reading the contract and they don't know when they signed Van Halen that there are some serious demands for the venue. So kind of an interesting thing. You know, there's always two sides to a story. And I had heard that years ago and read about it again. And what a cool group. Panama. It's a good song. I don't do it justice, but.
Your next item is, Mike, what
a
is it?
Royal Quiet Deluxe Portable Typewriter. This particular typewriter was the typewriter of choice for Ernest Hemingway.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good enough for Hemingway.
Yeah, and the one I have is around the same time. It's 1940s.
Maybe it was his. Wow. Maybe it was his. Maybe he could take it on Antiques Roadshow because it actually was his.
The assessor passes out. That guy has Ernest Hemingway's typewriter.
It's not nearly that dirty and doesn't smell as bad. I can't imagine Ernest Hemingway owning it.
Rough it up, pour some coffee on it and stuff like that and take it.
Yeah, it hasn't been gored by any bulls or stained with whiskey and stuff like that. But yeah, it's a great machine. I love it.
Is there any poetry that you'd like to share or anything that you have in mind that you've written?
Oh, sure. I've written about 150 poems. And just, in fact, I'm working on a project right now, which is where I'm putting together an ebook of my photographs of old barns, which has been a joy of mine. And I've written 9 major poems about barns. So the book is going to contain both the poetry and a bunch of my photographs of that. But in addition, I've written quite a few poems. If you'd like to hear some, I'd love to read them for you.
Yeah, a couple, 1 or 2 poems?
Sure.
Maybe 5?
Well, okay. This is one of my poems. It's a mood piece, so to speak. And the title is The Tree. And I've gotten some really good responses from people that have read this poem. I hope that it works the same way here.
Yeah.
After midnight, when no sound other than the gentle wind is in my leaves, it is time for reflection, to think of days that have been and days to come. In silence, I stand here, rooted to the ground, and dream of steps I cannot take. I dwell on memories of children playing in my branches. Their hooting cries brought joy. The swing that once arced over mown grass, a lowly rubber tire, a frayed cord, but in my arms, magic. I have seen generations come and go, and marvels revealed in constant array. From the time when gentle deer nibbled my leaves and the beauty of birds belled clear, families of squirrels have woven intricate circles round my trunk. Through heat and cold, wind and rain, I've mutually guarded all and observe it in gentle apathy. My purpose is to be, and I have done that admirably. Soon enough, I will make way for another growth, or not. And there will be none to remember, no memorial, no prayers, no tears. And that, too, is the way it should be.
Very nice, David.
I like that.
Yeah.
Another one. Okay, let's see now. I'm going to do something that I wrote in response to a story that I had read. I put it to rhyme. And again, my friend asked me to read this poem because she liked it. And it's called In the End. In the great hall they write, beginning with day's first light, 1,000 strong, cheek by jowl, their efforts, a constant scratching growl. Ink-stained fingers traverse the pages. Black-tipped fingers cause these sages to leave marks all around as names roll out to leap and bound. God has many names, it seems. Their goal, to list them all as reams of paper scroll upon the floor, covering all, and yet there's more. These earnest monks write as one, not one word passes any none. Shiva, Mortan, Bayak, Kral have long ago been written tall. Constatus, Allah, Creostopsis has passed on in their synopsis. All the names of God must follow, none can be allowed to wallow. What will be when all is done? Will they just fade away, be gone? Why the brothers' full devotion? The names pour out, a constant ocean. Still they write without end, nothing else must they attend. The names roll on, an endless stream. Rises, Mohammed, Beltan, Fain. The years fly by, and still they scroll. If one grows old, another installed. Generations come and go, but passions fall never low. Paper, pens, and ink without measure pass through fingers in their endeavor. Still more and more are writ. None will stop, none will quit. A millennium, and then the last name finally in pen. With trembling hand, the monk does indite. There is no more for any to write. They cease their labors and file outside, where star-filled skies greet their wondering eyes, and as they gaze in abject awe, each bright spot winks and is no more.
Cleese was a naughty man. I had all of them in the studio one day being interviewed, all the Monty Python people. Yeah. And of course, they were very naughty. I had a lot of trouble keeping them under control because they all moved around, and I couldn't. I had to keep them on mic somehow. And the interviewer was very seriously. It was right after they made The Life of Brian,
right?
And the interviewer was asking the producer. I can't think of his name. Sort of technical questions about the making of the film, and Cleese was getting bored, and he said, "Excuse me, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to check if I wanted to interrupt, would that be okay?" And he said, "Oh yeah, no problem." Right, and he goes back and he's trying to pick up where he left off, and then Cleese said, I'm just interrupting one more time. I'm awfully sorry, but I didn't want that to count as an interruption. I wanted to know if I could interrupt, if I wanted to interrupt." And he said, "Oh, yeah, right." trying to go back. And, of course, he kept that up until
the
poor guy was helpless.
Those are some of our favorite moments from last year.
Both of us are looking forward to 2018 and the fun we will have getting to know our future guests that little bit better.
We would like to thank you for listening throughout the past year, and to end the show, we would like to reflect on some of our guests' responses to our trademark question.
How do you take your coffee?
How do I take my coffee? That's tough. If I'm just looking for a caffeine fix, it's usually our light roast with a little bit of soy milk. But I would say my favorite drink would be a cortado.
How do I take my coffee? At 11 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And I take it with warm milk in it.
Warm milk?
Yeah.
Do you have to warm the milk in the microwave?
I do, which is going to be a problem in the hut in the forest.
Yeah.
Black, no sugar, thank you. maybe that accounts for my apology.
Ah, I don't drink coffee. Mountain Dew. That's how I get my caffeine.
Right now, if it's a drip coffee, I do just milk sugar, but I'm partial to Americanos now. So iced Americanos, which is just espresso and water. Yeah.
Did you understand any of that, Mike?
No.
Ooh, black.
No sugar.
No sugar.
No coffee. Cream.
No.
Ooh, how do I take my coffee? Very interesting question. I pretty much do not.
Oh, good question. If I'm out and it's I usually have a splash of milk in my coffee. If I'm home, usually black because I don't go shopping.
A splash.
Splash of milk. What kind of milk?
Skim.
Skim milk.
No skim. Splash of skimmed milk.
Just a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Now, do you drink good coffee or just any old coffee?
This is gas station coffee right here.
Right, let's move on.
I have a Keurig machine at home, and I love it, and it's really cool. And I have a whole box of Caribou coffee. I like that.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah. Average.
And he's a coffee connoisseur, so roasts his own beans and things.
Yeah, yes.
I don't take coffee at all because if you ask my wife, I don't make it, I don't drink it, and I don't clean it.
Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
And you've been listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations. Special thanks to George, Gordon and Billy from the band White for the theme music, and to everyone at WGXC, thanks.
Merry Christmas and have a Happy New Year.